From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. The Islamic State's attacks in Europe earlier this year made headlines all around the world. But there's another terrorist group that by some estimates has killed more civilians over the past few years than ISIS. That's Boko Haram in northern Nigeria, which killed more than 6,000 people last year. It's a group known for using tactics like child suicide bombers, for striking at churches during Christmas services, and for kidnapping schoolgirls, like the 276 taken from the town of Chibok in 2014. It's also deliberately targeted school teachers, killing more than 611 in targeted attacks since 2009, according to Human Rights Watch. But the group appears to have split in two, and in recent months, Boko Haram has lost much of the territory it controls to the Nigerian military and those of surrounding countries. Still, Boko Haram is able to launch terror attacks targeting civilians across much of northeastern Nigeria, and the violence has caused a humanitarian crisis that could lead to more people dying of starvation than bullets. About 2.5 million people have been forced from their homes by its attacks. Now, joining us first to talk about Boko Haram is Brandon Kendhammer. He's a political scientist at Ohio University and the author of the new book, Muslims Talking Politics, Democracy and Law in Northern Nigeria. Brandon, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thanks for having me.
Now, just back us up here. Boko Haram was formed about in 2002. In 2009 is when the group really became very violent and started carrying out some of these horrific attacks, attacking people in markets, in malls, in churches. What changed for the group?
So really, the triggering moment for Boko Haram becoming a violent group was a confrontation that they had with the state government in Borno, which is the area in Nigeria that they're from in the northeastern part of the country. And Yusuf, Muhammad Yusuf, the leader of the group, the original leader, was killed in a battle with police. In fact, he was arrested and then assassinated while in police custody. And that was really the breaking point for a lot of the members of the group, which drove them to engage in much more systematic violence against the Nigerian state. They went underground for about a year. They gathered resources and weapons, and then starting really in 2010, they've launched pretty continuous attacks since then.
And Nigeria, it's not a failed state like Somalia or Syria or Afghanistan. It has one of the best armies in Africa. So how has Boko Haram managed to not only endure but kind of thrive for so many years?
Well, it's a combination of a couple of factors. One is that Boko Haram's leadership and its fighters have proven very resilient in the face of state violence. They've been very adaptable. They've changed their strategies as situations have evolved. They've seemed to find ways to be able to find funding and access weapons, even when those things have been pretty difficult to do, often by stealing them from the Nigerian military. And of course, the Nigerian military, while being very big, is not quite as well trained or as effective in the field as it was in its heyday about a decade and a half ago when it was a big part of a lot of international peacekeeping operations. There's been a real degradation of the training, of the material that they have available. And so the Nigerian military's failures in this respect have played a really big role in Boko Haram's success.
Now, we know that ISIS has oil in Iraq and Syria. Al-Qaeda has made a lot of money ransoming hostages. How does Boko Haram get money to sustain itself?
So we know a lot less about that than we'd like to. And it seems to have shifted quite a bit. In their early days, they probably got a lot of funding from wealthy supporters. This was before the violence really kicks off, who were interested in supporting the group's religious message. In 2010, 2011, 2012, we know that there was a lot of looting and bank robbing and raiding police stations. There was a little bit of kidnapping. Kidnapping has from ransom has been a not super common but occasional strategy that they've employed. It's likely that they've gotten some resources from their connections with the Islamic State. But in large part, they seem to sort of live off the land in northeastern Nigeria to take advantage of the resources that are there. This is why they're forever being arrested in places like cattle markets. Like yesterday, a number of Boko Haram fighters were arrested trying to basically do a business deal.
And tell us what we know about the group's leadership. You talked about this period in 2009, 2010, when this guy named Abubakar Shekau took over the leadership of the group, and that's when it became really started employing these brutal tactics. He has been reportedly killed on four or five different occasions. There was just another video of him alive that just popped up a few days ago. So tell us what we know about the leadership. Now, there's been this talk of a split with another leader taking over. What's going on?
So, again, we don't know quite as much as we might like to. The leadership of Boko Haram has always been very opaque from the outside. And so we don't know very much, for example, biographically about Abubakar Shekau, who's long been the leader of the group. But it does appear that he is alive. We don't know exactly when this most recent video was filmed. But the side of the group that he seems to still be in control of has a reputation for attacking Muslims, for engaging in extraordinary levels of violence that seems to have alienated them, ironically enough, from some of their supporters within the Islamic State structure. And so this new branch or part of the group, but again, we're unclear about exactly all of the details, seems to be led by Muhammad Yusuf's son, the former original leader of the group in 2009. And they seem to be more willing to engage in moderation from the Islamic State's perspective. Certainly they're not moderates, but they seem to be willing to say publicly that they're less interested in engaging in violence against fellow Muslims and more about jihad, right, and the foundation of
Islam. So you're saying the Islamic State is actually a moderating influence on Boko Haram?
In comparison to some of the attacks that Abubakar Shekau has launched, which make it almost impossible to gain any kind of support on the ground. Really, there's very little evidence that there's mass support for Boko Haram, in large part because many of the victims are ordinary Muslims living in the northeastern part of the country.
Now, Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, he said the government, last year, he said the government had won a technical victory over Boko Haram. That seems to have been premature. And the army has made various statements in the past few months saying that Boko Haram was either already defeated or was just weeks away from being defeated. What's up with that?
So it's undoubtedly the case that Boko Haram has less military capacity than it did a year ago. In that sense, the election of a new president who is much more able to cooperate with other regional and international militaries has made a very big difference. There's less territory held by Boko Haram. There are fewer villages that are fall prey to Boko Haram attacks on a daily basis. But I think that it radically underestimates the difficulty of managing an insurgency that's able to launch attacks sort of at random or on a very small scale. It also doesn't really take into account that today, and I'm sure your panelists will speak about this later, the single biggest problem in northeastern Nigeria is not the daily violence of Boko Haram, but the humanitarian legacy of the conflict over the last 4 years, about which still very little has been done, to be honest.
We have just a couple seconds left. Brandon, tell us about the role of the U.S. It has been criticized by some Nigerian politicians in the past for blocking arms sales or for refusing arms sales to Nigeria. This year, the Obama administration said it might allow for the sale of some war planes to Buhari's government. What's changed?
Well, so there is a rule in the United States system for allocating financial resources and military aid called the Leahy Amendment, which requires that the U.S. not provide military assistance to units that have been accused of gross human rights violations. And the Nigerian military, as again, I'm sure some of your panelists will talk about later, does not have a really stellar record in its dealings with civilians. There is a sense that perhaps that's improving, but I think more importantly, the United States has provided a couple hundred of humanitarian assistance and aid over the last several years and seems to be pretty committed to continuing to do that. In fact, there was talk of another $41 million being allocated to northern Nigeria and the Lake Chad area in the forthcoming months.
Brandon Kendhammer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A reminder that you are listening to Global Journalist. We're talking today about Boko Haram, the terror group whose attacks have spurred a humanitarian crisis in northern Nigeria, an area that even in peacetime was one of the poorest places on earth. To expand our discussion, we're going to bring in three other guests now. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Emmanuel Ogebe, an activist and human rights lawyer with the U.S.-Nigeria Law Group. In the Nigerian capital, Abuja, is Mauzi Segun. She's a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch. Also in Abuja is Chitra Nagarajan, a women's rights activist and journalist who has written for The Guardian and other publications. Welcome to all of you. Emmanuel Ogebe, I wanted to start with you. Given sort of the number of people killed by Boko Haram in recent years and the scale of the humanitarian crisis, why do you think the situation has gotten less attention from the outside world than maybe some other events?
Well, that's one of the big questions, because even as we speak, the humanitarian crisis is one of the top four in the world, and it hasn't received the necessary classification by the United Nations in that category. Now, remember also that just last month, it was 5 years since Boko Haram bombed the United Nations headquarters in Abuja, which is one of the worst attacks on the UN. But the UN didn't designate Boko Haram an Al-Qaeda-related terror group until after the Chibok kidnappings. So clearly the world is behind on calling out this really terrible terror group. And we simply do not know why.
Well, let me turn this to Mao Zedong then. Last year, Boko Haram was said to control territory equivalent to the size of Belgium inside Nigeria. Now we've heard that the Nigerian military say it's just weeks from defeating them. How has the situation actually improved for people on the ground in northeastern Nigeria, or has it improved?
I would say that in terms of the regularity and the intensity of attacks, there is an improvement. But how that translates to improvement in living conditions for the people of the north is a different story entirely. As we know, about 2.5 million people have been displaced by the conflict, both within Nigeria and as refugees in neighboring countries. I was in Maiduguri in late July for about 2 weeks.
This is the biggest city in Borno State in northeastern Nigeria.
That is the capital of Borno State, and it is the spiritual home of Boko Haram. This is where Boko Haram was founded, where the leader and the founder of Boko Haram lived. Now in Maiduguri itself, most of the IDP population, the internally displaced people, are in camps. Outside of Maiduguri, a few inside Maiduguri, but the rest of them, between 80 to 90% of them, live in what we call host communities. They live with family, they live with friends, wherever they can find space. Now, for most of these people, about 70% of who are women and children, the men have simply disappeared. Men and boys have simply disappeared, mostly from northeast Nigeria. Now, for the women and children...
Wait, let me stop you there. You said the men have disappeared. What's happened to the men?
What has happened to the men is a big question. It's either one, the large number of people that Boko Haram have killed. We know that they targeted men in particular, whether it be in mosques or in homes. When they take over communities, they single out the men, because at some point in the conflict in 2013, men helped to group themselves as a self-defense force, supporting the Nigerian military to fight Boko Haram. And in retaliation, everywhere that Boko Haram went, they would single out the men for execution and then abduct and take away the women and the children. And so you would find that most of those who outlived the conflict, although it's not at an end already, despite what the Nigerian government says, are women and children. Also, on the side of the security forces, men, Kanuri Muslim men, have been targeted for arrest, mass arrest, detention, torture, extrajudicial killings. Thousands of them have disappeared from detention. And then you'll have those who have joined the vigilante groups who are fighting in the bush with Nigerian security forces. So outside of the conflict areas, the areas of oppression, women and children predominate.
Well, let me turn this to Chitra Nagarajan then, to pick up on what Mauzi has been saying about women and children in these displaced people's camps. I also wanted to ask you about the problem of abductions. A couple years ago, there was this huge international focus on this campaign to bring back our girls, focusing on the 270-some girls that have been abducted from the school in Chibok. What has happened with that? Have these girls been freed? Are these sorts of abductions still taking place?
Well, I think the first thing to remember is that the abductions from the government secondary school in Chibok were just some of the many abductions of women and girls that have taken place over the past few years in northeast Nigeria. Amnesty International estimated that at least 2,000 women and girls had been taken over a period of about 15 months. In addition, an issue that doesn't get much coverage is the abduction of boys and young men as well. And I think in terms of the Chibok girls specifically, in the weeks after the attack, we had a few of them escape themselves. And then since then, we've had the military rescue just one of those girls, and we don't know what's happened to them. We get some indications that they're being treated a bit differently in the BH camps than the other women and girls. One of the issues that women and girls face when they come back to their communities is the stigma and shame that they experience. Sometimes they're blamed for what happened to them whilst they were in captivity. Many of them have become pregnant Sorry, do you want me to do something with my audio?
Yeah, we're going to move to Emmanuel Ogebe next. Well, to pick up on this idea about the Bring Back Your Girls campaign, Emmanuel, can you talk to us about why did that receive so much attention when this seems to be an ongoing problem and it seems to have just disappeared from the headlines?
Well, the abductions of girls in northern Nigeria by Boko Haram had been going on a small scale before Chibok. And the Chibok abductions of 276 girls was so large scale that it really caught the world's attention. In fact, today is the 900th day since these girls were abducted. And there was a sense in humanity of outrage that girls just attending school was now a high-risk activity and were being either trafficked or sold or abused as sex slaves. Now, it was so bad that even Al-Qaeda denounced Boko Haram for abducting the girls. But ironically, ISIS responded to that by beginning to abduct Yazidi and Christian women in Iraq as well. And so that seemed to be a turning point in the world of global jihad, because some groups repudiated it and some others emulated it. And as you know, ISIS and Boko Haram have now essentially merged since last year.
Well, let me go back to Mousi Segun then, because you are touching on an issue that is particularly important now, and that's the plight of these 2.5 million people who have been displaced by the fighting in northeastern Nigeria. Now, what are their needs? What are some of the things that they require to live right now?
I think the very basic of them all is lack of access to food. Not just any food, but nutritional food. Many of the women have children, young children. Many are also falling pregnant. Unfortunately, by camp leaders, members of the civilian JTF, by security forces. Young girls as young as 12, 14, are falling pregnant even while in camp. Now, because feeding for them is a problem, it affects children, the children that they're nursing, a lot more. So you'll have problems with access to healthcare. Many of the children have malnutrition, are showing signs of malnutrition. They are very unhealthy. A little help is just about reaching them, because most of these displaced people are living in inaccessible areas in the northeast. Inaccessible because the military says so, because military operations are ongoing in those areas, and many of the displaced people are those who are evacuated from their homes and their communities by Nigerian security forces to take them out of harm's way. But it does mean that the restriction of movement for these displaced people who are in camps or in host communities, they are not allowed to move freely. It means that they cannot fend for themselves. It means that their farms continue to lie idle, even in the areas that have been freed from Boko Haram's attacks. They are unable to farm. Food shortages have become a huge problem, and consequently, lack of access to healthcare and just, you know, nutritional supplements has become a huge problem with thousands, tens of thousands of people near starvation.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. We're talking today about the terror group Boko Haram, a group whose massacres of civilians and abductions have led to a humanitarian crisis in northeastern Nigeria. We're joined by Emmanuel Ogebe, a human rights lawyer, Mousi Segun of Human Rights Watch, and Chitra Nagarajan, a women's rights activist and journalist in Nigeria. If you're interested more about this and other undercovered international issues, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read an interview with a researcher who made a recent visit to previously off-limits parts of neighboring Cameroon, where that country's military has also battled Boko Haram. We're also on social media. You can subscribe to us on YouTube, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at Global Jern. Chicho Nagarajan, I wanted to come back to you. Could you talk to how effectively people in Nigeria, how much credibility do they give to what the Nigerian government has to say about the situation now in northeastern Nigeria? Because we have seen that a number of their statements that they've made haven't actually been borne out by facts on the ground.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's one of the main dynamics leading to a loss of credibility of the Nigerian government. Many of the statements that have been made just simply have turned out to be true. I think the government, as much as anything...
I'm sorry, Chitra. We're getting some strange feedback on your microphone. Let me turn this to you, Emmanuel Ogebe, because corruption has been a serious issue in the Nigerian military. There have been reports of officers in the Nigerian army actually selling arms to Boko Haram. We have seen that President Buhari's government has gone after corruption in some sort of significant way, including against sort of the former First Lady of Nigeria, Patience Goodluck. Is there a sense that there's some real progress being made on this issue?
Well, unfortunately, the anti-corruption war seems to be one-sided or selective, because even the slush funds that the National Security Advisor, who is on trial, is supposed to have dished out, President Buhari himself benefited from it when he was given three bulletproof cars. So if you're going to try everyone who got money out of it, the president himself would have to face the music. But I wanted to also mention another problem that we have in Nigeria right now, which is the humanitarian crisis. Now, what is happening is, as we speak, we have food aid, which was shipped to Nigeria from the U.S., which arrived in June, which is still stuck in the port in Lagos. So the dysfunction in the government is not even helping international aid agencies and groups such as mine to get the food to the people who are dying on a daily basis. And let me add one quick point here about Boko Haram's attacks in Chibok this week. My contacts in Chibok said that the timing is so that they're able to disrupt the harvest of crops by the farmers and pillage them. So this is another factor that is contributing to the humanitarian crisis, which Boko Haram is intentionally and strategically doing.
Well, Mazi Sagun, let me go back to something that we referenced with Brandon Kendhammer. He spoke about human rights abuses committed by the Nigerian military. There have been reports that in Cameroon, that country's military has also committed human rights abuses on the populations in areas thought to have been infiltrated by Boko Haram. What do we know about what's going on?
I have to say that in addition to what the Cameroonian security is doing in Cameroon, under the Lake Chad Basin Commission agreement with Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Cameroon, as well as the Republic of Benin to some extent, the militaries from these soldiers from these countries are allowed to pursue Boko Haram fighters into Nigeria, which means that these attacks, the arrests, the killings of civilians in Nigerian territory is happening from the reports that Human Rights Watch has received. So along the borders with Cameroon, all the way from the northern edge of northeast Nigeria in Banki, downwards to the Mandara Mountains, where you have the Gwoza Hills and Kirawa, people have reported attacks by Cameroonian forces, killing villages, burning up villages in Fufore just earlier this year. An entire village was sacked by Cameroonian forces. And what we've heard is that up to 60 villages have suffered the same fate. And we have not gotten a response from the Nigerian military about what is happening. The Cameroonian forces deny it, but the villagers who are now displaced in IDP camps in northern Adamawa State and in some parts of Borno insist that their attackers are Cameroonian forces. And so you find that as the government forces move in to curtail Boko Haram, they are committing atrocities as well against local populations. And this is totally
Well, let me turn this to Chicho Nagarajan. We have had some problems with your line, but let's try it once again. Let's say that eventually the Nigerian government and its partners eventually succeed in defeating Boko Haram. What will some of the challenges be in rebuilding this part of West Africa?
I think it's going to be incredibly challenging. You have to remember that a lot of schools and hospitals were attacked, so we're going to have to rebuild infrastructure, look at roads. And perhaps the biggest challenge will be looking at issues of reconciling communities. There's a lot of distrust within and between communities at the moment. We need to look at the dynamics of return of IDPs back to their homes. There may be some tensions there between people who left and people who stayed, with people who stayed thinking of people who left as traitors and having abandoned them, whereas people who stayed being viewed with suspicion as members of Boko Haram or sympathizers. Will have a huge challenge in terms of disarmament, demobilization, reintegration, and rehabilitation of both Boko Haram fighters, but also members of the civilian JTF that Mauzi talked about earlier. This is a volunteer force of mainly young people who came together to defend their communities. And we'll have an entire population of young people who have either taken part in the fighting directly themselves or have been affected by it. And what does that mean for the future of Borno and other places in the Northeast, especially given that we have an entire generation of schoolchildren that has missed out on a number of really fundamental years of their schooling? So the challenges seem really immense at the moment. And I think especially given the amount of money and resources and political will that they will take, we need to be very careful that the dynamics that will be in place won't lead to a resurgence of either Boko Haram or another extremist violent group in the future.
Emmanuel Ogebe, we do have just about 30 seconds left. How do you see this conflict evolving over the next couple of years? Are you optimistic about the future?
Well, unfortunately, I am not very optimistic in the near term, because some of the territory that has been recaptured by the Nigerian army this year was territory they recaptured last year, which means there's an ebb and flow in the Boko Haram fight. So a lot needs to be done to ensure that this evil of our age is brought to an end, considering that Boko Haram is the deadliest terror group in the world today.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Chicho Nagarajan, Emmanuel Ogebe, Mauzi Segun, and Brandon Kendhammer for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Alejandra Arredondo, Huilan Zan, and Steve Dawson. Alisa Blyle is our graphics editor, and our producer is Vera Tan. Travis McMillan of RJI is our studio director. Pat Akers of KBIA is our audio engineer. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.